Hi, I'm Liz.
And I'm Riley.
We're the creators of It's Personal, a solo performance show based right here in the heart of Hollywood.
And now we're bringing that show to you.
On It's Personal, the podcast, we're exploring the true stories shared each month in front of a live audience.
You'll laugh, you'll cry.
You won't see any of it coming.
Join us every Monday morning on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and SoundCloud.
Find us on Insta, It's Personal On Stage.
And check out our website, itspersonalonstage.com.
Let's get personal.
Hello, friends. It's Allison again, and I am virtually here with my pal.
Hi, it's Max.
This is week four, final week of the Bitcher of History quarantine pandemic cycle. I feel like it's like the Bitcher of History season five.
Yeah. We hope that you guys are keeping it together, that 4 weeks has not turned your brains to mush. Remember that you can go out and walk around outside. Just stay 6 feet from everything.
It's honestly my favorite as an introvert because it's not weird anymore if I don't want to talk to people.
When you purposefully walk away from someone to go around on the sidewalk.
So great. Well, enjoy these final pieces read by our dear friends and family, of which we count you among.
Yeah. Thanks for listening. We'll see you in June and July.
Hopefully.
Yikes.
Well, I'm Lola No, and I met Allison in it used to be a class, and then it became a co-op, and now it's still a co-op, but it's a nonprofit, and it's based on actors and actors becoming filmmakers, so that's how she and I met, and we've co-produced many things together, which we both really enjoy, and so that's how I know Allison. The piece I'm going to read today is Emma Watson's speech at the UN, and it's about feminism, something I feel really strongly about, actually. I have a really good friend who has two boys that she is raising as feminists, which I think is really cool because we can't do it alone. Hope everybody is staying safe and healthy, and I really think this is an important piece. I mean, I just really think that it's something that should be repeated over and over and over again, because it has, and it's slowly gaining momentum, but I think we could use more. Today, we are launching a campaign called He for She. I'm reaching out to you because we need your help. We want to end gender inequality, and to do this, we need everyone involved. This is the first campaign of its kind at the UN. We want to try to mobilize as many men and boys as possible to be advocates for change. And we don't just want to talk about it. We want to try and make sure that it's tangible. I was appointed as Goodwill Ambassador for UN Women 6 months ago. And the more I spoke about feminism, the more I realized that fighting for women's rights has too often become synonymous with man-hating. If there's one thing I know for certain, it's that this has to stop. For the record, feminism by definition is the belief that men and women should have equal rights and opportunities. It is the theory of political, economic, and social equality of the sexes. I started questioning gender-based assumptions a long time ago. When I was 8, I was confused for being called bossy because I wanted to direct the plays that we would put on for our families, but the boys weren't. When at 14, I started to be sexualized by certain elements of the media. When at 15, my girlfriends started dropping out of sports teams because they didn't want to appear muscly. When at 18, my male friends were unable to express their feelings. I decided that I was a feminist, and this seemed uncomplicated to me. But my research has shown me that feminism has become an unpopular word. Women are chosen not to identify as feminists. Apparently, I'm among the ranks of women whose expressions are seen as too strong, too aggressive, isolating, and anti-men, unattractive even. Why has the word become such an uncomfortable one? I am from Britain, and I think it is right I am paid the same as my male counterparts. I think it is right that I should be able to make decisions about my own body. I think it is right that women be involved on my behalf in the policies and decisions that will affect my life. I think it is right that socially, I'm afforded the same respect as men. But sadly, I can say there is no one country in the world where all women can expect to see these rights. No country in the world can say yet that they've achieved gender equality. These rights I consider to be human rights, but I am one of the lucky ones. My life is a sheer privilege because my parents didn't love me less because I was born a daughter. My school did not limit me because I was a girl. My mentors didn't assume I would go less far because I might give birth to a child one day. These influencers were the gender equality ambassadors that made me who I am today. They may not know it, but they were the inadvertent feminists who are changing the world today, and we need more of those. And if you still hate the word, it is not the word that is important. It's the idea and the ambition behind it, because not all women have received the same rights I have. In fact, statistically, very few have. In 1995, Hillary Clinton made a famous speech in Beijing about women's rights. Sadly, many of the things she wanted to change are still true today. But what stood out for me the most was that less than 30% of the audience were male. How can we affect change in the world when only half of it is invited or feel welcome to participate in the conversation? Men, I would like to take this opportunity to extend your formal invitation. Gender equality is your issue too. Because to date, I've seen my father's role as a parent being valued less by society, despite my need of his presence as a child, as much as my mother's. I've seen young men suffering from mental illness, unable to ask for help for fear it would make them less of a man. In fact, in the UK, suicide is the biggest killer of men between 20 to 49. Eclipsing road accidents, cancer, and coronary heart disease. I've seen men made fragile and insecure by a distorted sense of what constitutes male success. Men don't have the benefits of equality either. We don't often talk about men being imprisoned by gender stereotypes, but I can see that they are, and that when they are free, things will change for women as a natural consequence. If men don't have to be aggressive in order to be accepted, women won't feel compelled to be submissive. Both men and women should feel free to be sensitive. Both men and women should feel free to be strong. It is time that we all perceive gender on a spectrum instead of two sets of opposing ideals. If we stop defining each other by what we are not and start defining ourselves by who we are, we can all be freer. And this is what He for She is about. It's about freedom. I want men to take up this mantle so that their daughters, sisters, and mothers can be free from prejudice, but also so that their sons have permission to be vulnerable and human too. Reclaim those parts of themselves they abandoned, and in doing so, be a more true and complete version of themselves. You might be thinking, who is this Harry Potter girl and what is she doing speaking at the UN? It's a really good question. I've been asking myself the same thing. All I know is I care about this problem and I want to make it better. And having seen what I've seen and given the chance, I feel it is my responsibility to say something. Statesman Edmund Burke said, "All that is needed for the forces of evil to triumph is for good men and women to do nothing." In my nervousness for this speech and in my moments of doubt, I told myself firmly, "If not me, who? And if not now, when?" If you have similar doubts when opportunities are presented to you, I hope these words will be helpful. Because the reality is that if we do nothing, it will take 75 years, or for me to be nearly 100, before women can expect to be paid the same as men for the same work. 15.5 million girls will be married in the next 16 years as children. And at current rates, it won't be until 2086 before all rural African girls will be able to receive a secondary education. If you believe in equality, you might be one of those inadvertent feminists that I spoke of earlier, and for this I applaud you. We are struggling for a uniting word, but the good news is we have a uniting movement. It is called He for She. I invite you to step forward, to be seen, and ask yourself, if not me, who? And if not now, when? Thank you very, very much. In the words of Gloria Gaynor, I will survive. And in the words of Lola No, so will you.
This is still Allison. I'm going to read to you Nora Ephron's address to the graduates of Wellesley College in 1996. And this piece was sent in to us by our dear friend Marguerite, who did not want to record it herself, but still wanted to share these words, which makes total sense because it's a great speech, because Nora Ephron's a great writer, or was a great writer. Marguerite is an incredible friend and was on the fundraising team for Banging Laney, is just a true champion of female friendships and awesome women throughout all time, and is one herself. President Walsh, trustees, faculty, friends, noble parents, and dear class of 1996, I am so proud of you. Thank you for asking me to speak to you today. I had a wonderful time trying to imagine who had been ahead of me on the list and had said no. I was positive you'd have gone to Martha Stewart first. And I meant to call her to see what she would have said, but I forgot. She would probably be up here telling you how to turn your lovely black robes into tents. I will try to be at least as helpful, if not quite as specific as that. I'm very conscious of how easy it is to let people down on a day like this, because I remember my own graduation from Wellesley very, very well, I am sorry to say. The speaker was Santha Rama Rao, who was a woman writer, and I was going to be a woman writer. And in fact, I had spent 4 years at Wellesley going to lectures by women writers, hoping that I would be the beneficiary of some terrific secret, which I never was. And now here I was at graduation, under these very trees, absolutely terrified. Something was over, something safe and protected, and something else was about to begin. I was heading off to New York, and I was sure that I would live there forever and never meet anyone and end up dying in one of those New York deaths where no one even notices you're missing until the smell drifts into the hallway weeks later. And I sat here thinking, okay, Santa, this is my last chance for a really terrific secret. Lay it on me. And she spoke about the need to place friendship over love of country, which I must tell you had never crossed my mind one way or the other. I want to tell you a little bit about my class, the class of 1962. When we came to Wellesley in the fall of 1958, there was an article in the Harvard Crimson about women's colleges, one of those stupid, mean little articles full of stereotypes, like girls at Bryn Mawr wear black. We were girls then, by the way, Wellesley girls. How long ago was it? It was so long ago that while I was here, Wellesley actually threw 6 young women out for lesbianism. It was so long ago that we had curfews. It was so long ago that if you had a boy in your room, you had to leave the door open 6 inches. And if you closed the door, you had to put a sock on the doorknob. In my class of, I don't know, maybe 375 young women, there were 6 Asians and 5 Blacks. There was a strict quota on the number of Jews. Tuition was $2,000 a year, and in my junior year, it was raised to $2,250, and my parents practically had a heart attack. How long ago? If you needed an abortion, you drove to a gas station in Union, New Jersey with $500 cash in an envelope, and you were taken blindfolded to a motel room and operated on without an anesthetic. On the lighter side, and as you no doubt read in the New York Times magazines, and we were flabbergasted to learn, there were the posture pictures. We not only took off most of our clothes to have our posture pictures taken, we took them off without ever even thinking, this is weird. Why are we doing this? Not only that, but we also had speech therapy. I was told I had a New Jersey accent I really ought to do something about, which was a shock to me since I was from Beverly Hills, California, and had never set foot in the state of New Jersey. Not only that, we were required to take a course called Fundamentals, Fundies, where we were actually taught how to get in and out of the back seat of the car. Some of us were named things like Winky. We all parted our hair in the middle. How long ago was it? It was so long ago that among the things that I honestly cannot conceive of life without that had not yet been invented, pantyhose, lattes, Advil, pasta, there was no pasta then. There was only spaghetti and macaroni. I sit here writing the speech on a computer next to a touch-tone phone with an answering machine and a Rolodex. There are several CDs on my desk, a bottle of Snapple. There are felt-tip pens and an electric pencil sharpener. Well, you get the point. It was a long time ago. Anyway, as I was saying, The Crimson had this snippy article which said that Wellesley was a school for tunicata. Tunicata apparently being small fish who spend the first part of their lives frantically swimming around the ocean floor, exploring their environment, and the second part of their lives just lying there breeding. It was mean and snippy, but had the horrible ring of truth. It was one of those do not ask for whom the bell tolls things, and it burned itself into our brains. Years later, at my 25th reunion, one of my classmates mentioned it, and everyone remembered what tunicata were, word for word. My class went to college in the era where you got a master's degree in teaching because it was something to fall back on, in the worst case scenario. The worst case scenario being that no one married you and you actually had to go to work. As this same classmate said at our reunion, our education was a dress rehearsal for a life we never led. Isn't that the saddest line? We weren't meant to have futures. We were meant to marry them. We weren't meant to have politics or careers that mattered or opinions or lives. We were meant to marry them. If you wanted to be an architect, you married an architect. Non minstre sed minstre. You know the old joke. Not to be ministers, but to be ministers' wives. I've written about my years at Wellesley, and I don't want to repeat myself any more than is necessary, but I do want to retell one anecdote from the piece I did about my 10th Wellesley reunion. I'll tell it a little differently for those of you who read it, which was that during my junior year, when I was engaged for a very short period of time, I thought I might transfer to Barnard my senior year. I went to see my class dean, and she said to me, "Let me give you some advice. You've worked so hard at Wellesley. When you marry, take a year off. Devote yourself to your husband and your marriage." Of course, it was a stunning piece of advice to give me because I'd always intended to work after college. My mother was a career woman, and all of us, her four daughters, grew up understanding that the question, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" was as valid for girls as for boys. Take a year off being a wife? I always wondered what I was supposed to do in that year. Iron? I repeated the story for years as proof that Wellesley wanted its graduates to be merely housewives. But I turned out to be wrong because years later I met another Wellesley graduate who had been as hell-bent on domesticity as I had been on a career. And she had gone to the same dean with the same problem, and the dean had said to her, "Don't have children right away. Take a year to work." And so I saw that what Wellesley wanted for us was to avoid the extremes, to be instead that thing in the middle, a lady. We were to take the fabulous education we had received here and use it to preside at dinner tables or a committee meeting, and when two people disagreed, we would be intelligent enough to step in and point out the remarkable similarities between their two opposing positions. We were to spend our lives making nice. Many of my classmates did exactly what they were supposed to do when they graduated from Wellesley, and some of them, by the way, lived happily ever after. But many of them didn't. All sorts of things happened that no one expected. They needed money, so they had to work. They got divorced, so they had to work. They were bored witless, so they had to work. The women's movement came along and made harsh value judgments about their lives. Judgments that caught them by surprise because they were doing what they were supposed to be doing, weren't they? The rules had changed. They were caught in some kind of strange time warp.
They had never intended to be the heroines of their own lives. They'd intended to be, what? First ladies, I guess. First ladies in the lives of big men. They ended up feeling like victims. They ended up, and this is really sad, thinking that their years in college were the best years of their lives. Why am I telling you this? It was a long time ago, right? Things have changed, haven't they? Yes, they have. But I mention it because I want to remind you of the undertow, of the specific gravity. American society has a remarkable ability to resist change, or to take whatever change has taken place and attempt to make it go away. Things are different for you than they were for us. Just the fact that you chose to come to a single-sex college makes you smarter than we were. We came because it's what you did in those days. And the college you are graduating from is a very different place. All sorts of things caused Wellesley to change, but it did change. And today, it's a place that understands its obligation to women in today's world. The women's movement has made a huge difference too, particularly for young women like you. There are women doctors and women lawyers. There are anchor women, although most of them are blonde. But at the same time, the pay differential between men and women has barely changed. In my business, the movie business, there are many more women directors, but it's just as hard to make a movie about women as it ever was. And look at the parts Oscar-nominated actresses played this year. Hooker, 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 and none. It's 1996, and you are graduating from Wellesley in the year of the Wonder Bra. The Wonder Bra is not a step forward for women. Nothing that hurts that much is a step forward for women. What I'm saying is, don't delude yourself that the powerful cultural values that wreck the lives of so many of my classmates have vanished from the earth. Don't let the New York Times article about the brilliant success of Wellesley graduates in the business world fool you. There's still a glass ceiling. Don't let the number of women in the workforce trick you. There are still lots of magazines devoted almost exclusively to making perfect casseroles and turning various things into tents. Don't underestimate how much antagonism there is toward women and how many people wish we could turn the clock back. One of the things people always say to you if you get upset is, don't take it personally, but listen hard to what's going on and please, I beg you, take it personally. Understand, every attack on Hillary Clinton for not knowing her place is an attack on you. Underneath almost all those attacks are the words, get back. Get back to where you once belonged. When Elizabeth Dole pretends that she isn't serious about her career, that is an attack on you. The acquittal of O.J. Simpson is an attack on you. Any move to limit abortion rights is an attack on you, whether or not you believe in abortion. The fact that Clarence Thomas is sitting on the Supreme Court today is an attack on you. Above all, be the heroine of your life, not the victim, because you don't have the alibi my class had. This is one of the great achievements and mixed blessings you inherit. Unlike us, you can't say nobody told you there were other options. Your education is a dress rehearsal for a life that is yours to lead. 25 years from now, you won't have as easy a time making excuses as my class did. You won't be able to blame the deans or the culture or anyone else. You will have no one to blame but yourselves. Whoa. So what are you going to do? This is the season when a clutch of successful women who have it all give speeches to women like you and say, to be perfectly honest, you can't have it all. Maybe young women don't wonder whether they can have it all any longer, but in case you are wondering, of course you can have it all. What are you going to do? Everything is my guess. It will be a little messy, but embrace the mess. It will be complicated, but rejoice in the complications. It will not be anything like what you think it will be like. But surprises are good for you. And don't be frightened. You can always change your mind. I know. I've had 4 careers and 3 husbands. And this is something else I want to tell you. One of the hundreds of things I didn't know when I was sitting here so many years ago. You are not going to be you, fixed and immutable, forever. We have a game we play when we're waiting for tables in restaurants, where you have to write the 5 things that describe yourself on a piece of paper. When I was your age, I would have put ambitious, Wellesley graduate, daughter, Democrat, single. 10 years later, not one of those 5 things turned up on my list. I was journalist, feminist, New Yorker, divorced, funny. Today, not one of those 5 things turns up in my list. Writer, director, mother, sister, happy. Whatever those five things are for you today, they won't make the list in 10 years. Not that you still won't be some of those things, but they won't be the five most important things about you, which is one of the most delicious things available to women, and more particularly to women than men, I think. It's slightly easier for us to shift, to change our minds, to take another path. Yogi Berra, the former New York Yankee, who made a specialty of saying things that were famously maladroit, quoted himself at a recent commitment speech he gave. When you see a fork in the road, he said, take it. Yes, it's supposed to be a joke, but as someone said in a movie I made, don't laugh, this is my life. This is the life many women lead. Two paths diverge in a wood, and we get to take them both. It's another of the nicest things about being women. We can do that. Did I say it was hard? Yes, but let me say it again so that none of you can ever say the words, nobody said it was so hard. But it's also incredibly interesting. You're so lucky to have that life as an option. Whatever you choose, however many roads you travel, I hope that you choose not to be a lady. I hope you will find some way to break the rules and make a little trouble out there. And I also hope that you will choose to make some of that trouble on behalf of women. Thank you. Good luck. The first act of your life is over. Welcome to the best years of your lives. Thank you so much for listening to that speech, which is sadly still pretty relevant here in 2020. So I hope you enjoyed it. Go out and make some trouble. Bitches get stuff done.
My name is Anna, and I am a friend of Max Kirkham, and we are also former co-workers. And I am here sitting on my bedroom floor about to read you a book that I read in the past year. And that's usually, I usually read one book a year, and that's on a good year. And this book is about a woman who moved to Alaska when she was 26 years old. And she was intending to stay there for one summer, and it's been over two decades later, and she still lives there. This book is called It Happened Like This, A Life in Alaska by Adrienne Lindholm. I just kind of love it. I've recognized myself in a lot of what she writes, and it's just kind of, I think, with everything that's been going on, it's kind of forced all of us to slow down and to sit down, and that includes the earth a little bit, and the earth is kind of benefiting from all of us slowing down and sitting down. So in honor of Earth Day a couple of days ago, I thought it would be nice to read words from someone who probably loves the earth most than a lot of us do. Heading to Alaska, I settled back into my airplane seat, closed my eyes, and smiled at the thought of that Colorado summer, because it was during that summer I'd felt direction for the first time. It wasn't a sense of north or south. It was a feeling of my inner compass could and would find its own way. The destination hadn't been clear, but I'd had the vague sense that to discover my own truth, I should hold the magic of wild places close to my core. As soon as I graduated from college, I'd moved to Boulder, Colorado for the next several years, funded my outdoor lifestyle by working as a receptionist and secretary at an engineering firm, a laborer in the city's forestry division, and a salesperson at an outdoor equipment store. Outside of work, I'd sunk into mountain meadows, felt western waters run through me, and skipped through my days collecting encounters with beauty like a child plucking dandelion crowns. I'd learned lessons in scale and perspective, and the power of the mountains had dazzled me. I'd had no choice but to let them nudge me into a new course. It was one that would lead me far from my childhood home to a new home. I had played in the mountains and chased adventures and boys in Colorado, Utah, and Montana, never staying anywhere long enough to fit in. I had learned how to mountain bike and begun competing in races. I had followed new friends up imposing peaks and learned how to navigate with a map and compass and how to travel lightly. I had embarked on solo excursions and long-distance hikes. I'd been afraid of getting lost, afraid of getting hurt, afraid of not making it. And sometimes I had gotten lost or hurt, and sometimes I had failed to do what I had intended. But I had learned something, and every day felt stronger and more competent. What if the next place is more beautiful, I had thought. What if it had greater challenges? What if people are more intriguing? So I kept moving. Without the responsibilities of family, children, a career, or even a hint of a serious romantic relationship, I had been totally free to test myself in ways that most of my peers from Pennsylvania were unable to. I had wanted to form my own opinions without the constraints and feedback from my family, bosses, or boyfriends that might make my choices less mine. Many people I knew back east, including my family, seemed happy there and enjoyed nature too, but there was something about so much development and busyness that didn't feel right to me. Maybe I couldn't handle the expectation of securing a high-paying career and owning a big house, but those things didn't feel rewarding to me. The farther I am from the East, I thought, the better chance I'll have of defining success for myself. Then someone had mentioned Alaska, the biggest mountains of all, they'd said, and I knew I had to go. As the plane winged north, I rifled through the spiral-bound notebook to review the page where I'd scribbled my approach to living. I tilted the notebook away from my seatmate so that she couldn't peek. 1. Respect nature. 2. Religion is neither practical nor useful. As Dad says, don't believe for a minute there's some God out there who's going to save you. Spirituality, is that a new age term for religion? 3. Technology and development, evil, obviously. Fight development where it threatens nature. 4. Children compromise a woman's ability to wring the nectar from life. I, for one, will not be having any. 5. Killing, including hunting, is barbaric and wrong. 6. Don't rely on anyone to take care of you. You don't need a husband. Alaska will be a good place to live by these tenets, I thought. The rundown hostel in Fairbanks, where I spent my first night in Alaska, fit perfectly into the way I thought my world should be ordered. This was a real cabin in Alaska with log construction, creaky floorboards, and old traps and mining equipment tracked to the walls. I was assigned to a room and found my way into an empty bunk. The room was cluttered with backpacks, shower sandals, drying laundry, and 8 other people. They must be true travelers, I thought. I'm on my way to Denali, I told them with feigned confidence, which got a nod of approval. But I had nothing else to contribute, so I sat quietly on my bed and listened to tales of where they'd been and where they were headed. They spoke of towns and mountains and rivers I'd never heard of. As I climbed into bed, I wrapped myself in my sleeping bag to stay warm. I waited for darkness to set in, but it never did, so I put a shirt over my eyes to block the light of the midnight sun. Haunted by thoughts of what the summer might be like, I rolled from one side to the other, most of the night. The following morning, bleary-eyed and somewhat dazed, I took the shuttle down to Parks Highway to Denali National Park, where I'd gotten a job as a backcountry ranger through the Student Conservation Association. After spending 6 months through hiking the Appalachian Trail and otherwise hiking and biking in the Rocky Mountains nearly every day since I graduated from college, I thought I had a fair amount of backcountry experience. So did the rest of the 20-somethings who had come from around the country to spend a summer in Alaska's premier national park, where Denali, the tallest mountain in North America, rises ghostly white to more than 20,000 feet and enchants the sea of green tundra that surrounds it. When our supervisor assigned us our first backcountry patrol, I found myself paired with Jeff, the only member of the backcountry staff who actually lived permanently in the area. The other rangers sat with their partners and excitedly ran their fingers over maps, speculating on what they might encounter and deciding what gear they should share and how many days of food to plan for. Jeff, meanwhile, seemed to roll his eyes as he looked over those in the group, most of whom were about half his age. As I walked towards him, he turned his back to put on his jacket. I paused beside a large wall map of the park and searched for the drainage we'd been assigned. When Jeff scooped up his belongings and headed for the door, I sheepishly intercepted him. "So you know where we're going?" "Been going there for decades," he said, with a look that added, "How about you?" "Anything in particular I should bring?" I asked. "Standard stuff," he said. "We'll take the camper bus tomorrow at 10. See you there." He turned and walked out the door. I winced and stood there for a minute, hoping no one would witness my rejection. Quietly, I gathered my things and slunk back to my cabin. Maybe I never should have come here, I thought. How could my supervisor have paired me with him? I threw my bag across the bed and sat down with a sick feeling in my stomach. Although the weather was delightful the next day, my stomach was still in knots as Jeff and I rode the bus into the park. Hours passed while I stared out the window and listened to other passengers' conversations. As the bus approached the rise in the road by the stony overlook, everyone on the bus gasped at the same time. People cut off their conversations and stared at Denali, the 20,310-foot massive looming giant and snowy out of the tundra foreground. Some people were moved to tears, and I quickly blinked to stifle my own emotion, embarrassed to show any sign of vulnerability to Jeff. The bus driver remained silent, knowing that when the simple act of viewing a mountain took his passenger's breath away, there was nothing he needed to say. Whatever happens, I thought, this was the most amazing place I've ever been. I had planned to stay for just 4 months, but a year later, I was still in Alaska, living near Anchorage in Eagle River, and working as an outdoor recreation planner for Denali National Park. Maybe it was the wild animals, or maybe it was the clean air and water. It could have been experiencing the rivers and glaciers and canyons on such an immense scale that one summer wouldn't suffice to absorb so much beauty. But I don't think that was the main reason. I think what kept me here is what all those things add up to. I wonder if that's what Ranger Jeff was trying to tell me. What makes this place special is what those tangible things collectively represent. It's the sense of something whole and complete and free from human control. In the Denali wilderness, I had experienced a force much greater than myself. It seeped into my psyche and began to sculpt my inner landscape, and then I had no choice. I needed to stick around to see what would happen next. I hope everybody's hanging in there. I hope everybody is washing their hands and getting some sunshine and just taking it one day at a time, as we all can do. I do not have any sort of parting wisdom to leave you with, but I do have a love of Dolly Parton. So I would like to end this with Max choosing his favorite Dolly Parton song to lead us out of here. Everyone, be good, be kind, be well. I'll see y'all later.
It's been a long, dark night, and I've been waiting for the morning. It's been a long, but I see a brand new day dawning. I've been looking for the sunshine. Lord knows I ain't seen it in so long. But everything's gonna work out just fine. Everything's gonna be alright. It's been all wrong. Can see the light of a clear blue morning.
Thanks so much for listening to The Bitchery of History. As always, if you'd like to keep in contact with us during these crazy times, keep in touch with us through our website,
thebitcheryofhistory.com,
on social media.
Just search The Bitchery of History on all of those platforms that you are now literally on 24/7.
You can find me at Quirky Title on Instagram.
And I'm just at Allison H. Powell. Two L's in Allison, two L's in Powell.
As always, The Vitry of History is a production of Ursula Major Productions. And until next time, remember, bitches, get stuff done.